Okay, so last week I gave a talk on working with loss and for some reason at the beginning, which escapes me now, I said I was going to give a talk on relationships. So we'll see how this goes. I scribbled down some notes before I came. I have a thing about all those books with titles like Buddhism and Relationships, If the Buddha Was Married. They make me cringe. And I do have to say that, of course, I'm pretty traditional in that I tend to give my teachings, I adhere very closely to the original teachings of the Buddha. And the Buddha discussed so much of the ways, he basically covered the ground when it comes to the way the mind causes suffering and the way the mind can develop skills and train itself to not cause suffering, to not cause unnecessary stress. And he actually wrote taught an entire set of teachings called the Vinaya, spelled V-I-N-A-Y-A, which is the code of conduct for the monks on how to live together. And certainly there's a lot of teachings in there that I'm going to apply tonight. And many of the other teachings to the lay practitioners, but some of this is just from my experience as a long-time practitioner. Principles that I've discovered from my spiritual practice that tend to work very well in relationships. So I'm not going to be discussing tonight, if you're interested simply in finding out how to have purely a sexual relationship with someone else, with nothing else, which there are many people that's all they want, and that's fine, but I'm not really going to cover that. So when I talk about relationships, I'm talking about something more than fuck buddies. So bear that in mind. So, for a moment, I know we just meditated, but just close your eyes for a quick, brief moment, and think about the one thing, or it can be two things, but find the one thing that, if you're not in a relationship, or even if you are, you would hope to get from being in a relationship. And obviously, putting aside sex, that's we're just talking about right now, other stuff. What is it you would like? And then you can open your eyes. And please don't tell me what it is. But it's a good test, because whatever it is we would want to get in a relationship is often a very good guide of what we're not giving ourselves, what we're not offering ourselves in our day-to-day life right now. What are we not appreciating? What are we not doing for ourselves? For example, if we thought to ourselves, I'd like somebody to accept me, it's a very good sign that we're probably being far too critical with ourselves. We're looking for acceptance from someone else because in our minds we judge ourselves. We don't accept ourselves. We don't feel comfortable with who we are. If we are looking for support, it means that we're probably not rewarding ourselves for our efforts, that we're not appreciating our skillfulness, that we're not providing ourselves with a sense of satisfaction at our accomplishment, that we're setting the bar too high. one of the oldest Buddhist perspectives is to turn the focus away from, first of all, what it is we crave, and to focus on appreciating and working with what we have. Basically, embracing our lives as it is, rather than as we would want it to be. I once was at a dinner, a wedding dinner with a woman who was a, what would she call her? A life guide. A life guide. And I was amazed that people actually make money from this. Here I am giving this all away for free. Actually, you're not supposed to get money from, and as far as the Buddha thought, from this, but so anyway, she was charging money from it, but I was interested in like what she was offering, what the good she was offering, and she talked about, she was working with a woman who really wanted to have a child, and she was telling me about all these spiritual practices that she was giving this woman, everything from different kinds of prayers and stuff like that, different kinds of positive thinking about the, what the child would be named and how the child would look and stuff like that. And I asked her, well, what about just embracing her life as it is? And the life guide looked stunned at that notion. So, and that's funny because that would be the first thing that would occur to me. What would be, what, you know, I mean, there's nothing wrong with wanting to have children, certainly. There's nothing wrong with wanting to be in a relationship. But it's very often this craving, this energy, this need that makes relationships so difficult. Because we're not coming into relationships as fully, often fully happy, self-contained people who feel that their lives are rich and rewarding. Often we go into relationships wanting something. We feel incomplete. No, that's not everybody. Many people, I'm sure, in this room feel completely complete without a relationship and are not looking for anything. But there are times in life where we feel like there's something missing in life when we're not in a relationship. Like we feel we can't travel or we can't be happy. We feel there's no one enjoying life with us. There's something we feel that's lacking. And I found that, for me, the key to being in a relationship comfortably is to first have my life as enriching, as rewarding, feeling as good and as positive and feeling as grateful as I can for all my skillful actions, for acting as positively as I can to make my life as rich without needing it from someone else, so that when I'm in a relationship, I'm coming from a place not of wanting something, not of asking you to give it to me, but of already having it and offering to share it. If somebody wants it, that's great. So that's, I think, the very first thing to focus on, I think, from a Buddhist perspective on this topic. It's important when we have, when we feel enriched in our lives, that we can allow our significant others, which is a term I hate, but I really don't know what else to use. People use partners, lovers. Lovers I despise with my... There was an old Saturday Night Live skit where people said, my lover, and it totally captured like how repellent I find that phrase. So I'm just going to use significant other as little as I possibly can, but lacking any other term. It's when we feel enriched and we feel like there's nothing missing from our lives, then it's okay when the person we're in a relationship with wants other stuff often than what we want. God knows, and this is where, and I'm going to talk a lot about this, where the idea of having a support group is so important for relationships. There's this tendency, my friends and I used to, back in the day, used to call it bisolating, where we're often with our friends and, you know, we have actually pretty outgoing lives, and then we find someone, we have sex, and we feel great, and then we bisolate. We isolate with them, and then suddenly we're not going out and doing a lot of the things that made our life feel so good. And we sort of, you know, because we're so enjoying the our significant other, there's this, we're okay letting go of going out to music or seeing some of our friends or doing whatever stuff made life seem enriching. And then once the neurotransmitters wear off, we want the other person then to start doing what we like. And sometimes they don't like what we like. God knows I have never met a woman who likes the kind of music that I like. I'm sure they're out there. I know because I see other women at the concerts that I go to, but they've yet to so I have friends that I go to see Mastodon with. I don't, I don't drag people to it as hostages and force them to do that. So it's very important to have a sustaining group of friends so that we can not expect or try to get, oh, you love this movie that I love. It's great. There's exploding heads in it. And they're like, oh, my God. You know, so it gives, also, it's great to extend enrich our lives, make our lives bigger, and not expect the other person in our lives to be the one that delivers that friendship, that companion. Positive, strong relationships do not exist in a vacuum. They don't. They exist with support. That's the crucial ingredient. There is no such thing as I'm sure there might be of like a couple that lives on a yacht that just spends their lives sailing around the world, but I suspect that even them require to get on the phone and talk to their friends and have an outlet, which is another important thing. If we're in a relationship, we need to have that support group also as a place to vent and to talk about the things that are causing stress for ourselves, the frustrations. If we are using that one person as our sounding board, we will become angry the first moment they're not receptive or they're not empathetic with us. And we can tell that we have too little support when we start expecting a response from someone. Everybody has the right to respond the way they respond. If we don't get what we need, it's up to us to find from our support group the support and the insight we need. The Buddha, with his son in the Rahula Sutta, talked about the key to growing spiritually is to have wise spiritual people, not person, but people in our lives, so that whenever we start realizing that we're stressed out, we're suffering, we can have people to go to where we can say, this is what I've done, this is what I'm doing, this is what I'm expecting. What's your experience with this? Am I being unreasonable? Am I asking too much? What's going on? And the key to spiritual friends is that they not be yes men. That you don't call up necessarily first only wanting somebody to say, you're right, your girlfriend, boyfriend's significant other is being a shit on this. The real goal is to have people that are willing to call you on your shit. Because frankly, one of my experiences in relationships is that Expecting anyone to change for me is the biggest waste of time ever. I practice the other approach, which is expecting people not to change. Well, I'm always grateful if they do change positively, but I expect that if there's something that's causing stress, it's up to me to see what expectations, what am I bringing, what am I focusing on that is causing the stress to arise. So rather than hoping that putting the fixation on the external, the person I'm with, of course the core, the key to Buddhist spiritual practice is seeing, okay, there's suffering going on here, there's stress going on here, I am in some way the author of it. Buddha said that by and large, we are the authors of our own stress and suffering. And that's good news. Because if you're going to depend on somebody to change, to make you happy, your happiness is held hostage. You have no control over it. Zero. If other people hold the key to your peace of mind, you're pretty much fucked. You heard it here. On the other hand, if you realize that the bulk of your peace of mind is authored by your own actions and your own thoughts, and it is, believe me, not all of it, but the bulk of it, then you actually control how peaceful you are from your own actions, your own thoughts. That's really, you can control those things. You actually have a say in those things. Now, one of the keys, and this is probably the biggest one to swallow. You think I haven't asked you to swallow a lot already, but here it comes. The key, of course, to relationships, doesn't matter whether they're friendships or more, is of course the ability to communicate. The ability to communicate is founded on the ability to listen. And one of the things that most compromises our ability to listen is that we tend to become very defensive when people talk about actions that we've taken that they don't like. In other words, we tend to think that our actions, the things that we do, is in some way an extension of ourself. That if somebody's criticizing an action, they're going to the root core of us and they're saying, you're a shitty person. Part of the key of the Buddhist teachings is, of course, to let go of this tendency we have of selfing, this tendency we have of becoming, taking ownership of things that really are changing and do not have a fixed core identity. For example, we get very often caught up in what our reputation is. We think people are speaking about us and we don't like that fact. Maybe they're speaking harshly about me behind my back. We believe that there's this thing called a reputation and that it exists. But even if there is such a thing as a reputation, whatever it is changing constantly, and we have no control over it whatsoever because it's other people talking, constantly changing, saying different things, and we're not even there. So worrying about it is a waste of time. And frankly, it's also something that is totally mutable. It's totally changing. The same with our actions. We are capable, each and every one of us, of infinite levels of insight and wisdom, calmness, and we're also capable of saying some of the dumbest things that are imaginable. Each and every person, we all have it in us. We all say things that are sometimes doozies. Believe me, I can make a real ass of myself. Also, I say things that after I say them, I'm like, wow, that was really bright. I'm a schmarty. And that's where I get into trouble, because the moment I start attaching to an action, like I say something smart and say, ooh, that defines who I am. I'm a schmarty. I'm a smart person. That's where I start to get into trouble. Because once I start clinging to this idea that I am smart, when I say something stupid, then I have to somehow make sure that people didn't understand what I said, or that you misunderstood me, or I have to deny it. I didn't say that, because I'm smart. I don't say stupid things. But if I let go of taking ownership and simply try to not self in this way, not take things as definitions of who I am. If somebody says, for example, you know, the way you, I'm going to think of something that nobody said, so I don't know. The way you load clothes into the washing machine is terrible. You don't put the whites and separate them from the colors, right? Now, if I listen to that and I just think, well, okay, that's an action they're talking about. That's not who I am. That's just an action. Then I can think, well, damn right I do that. There's nothing wrong with it. Or I can say, oh, you're right. That probably is causing my clothes to suddenly lose the whites are getting colored or whatever. I don't have to defend it immediately. I don't have to become defensive and guard that action. I don't have to feel that that action is attached to me. It's just an action. That's the key to listening, to not think that in any way we, our core identity, our self, is being attacked, is being derided, belittled, simply to understand that specific actions are being talked about. Even if somebody globalizes, which means turn a single incident into a tendency and says you never pick up the towels. Whatever. It's still actions. It still doesn't define. You never listen. You're not engaged enough. You don't like eating out enough. You don't like eating in enough. Whatever. These are still actions. They do not define who we are. They do not in any way reflect on any core identity. Once we can detach and just view these as actions that are being criticized, we can sit there. And part of the Buddhist practice that makes this possible is to be able to relax the body and keep our awareness internally focused. The moment I'm 100% externally focused on you and what you're saying, right, I'm going to be much more reactive because I'm not aware of the stress building up in my body. I'm not aware of my stomach tightening. I'm not aware of my shoulders going up. I'm not aware of my throat tightening. I'm not aware of the skin on my forehead or the hair in the back of my neck. I'm not aware of any of that. I'm totally externally focused, and then the body can stress up because the conversation might remind us of an earlier conversation with a parent who might have been extremely critical. And when we feel criticized, then our bodies become tight and then we become reactive. We have to say, I don't want to hear this. You're a shithead. You do the same thing too. Whatever. We want to make it go away because we're feeling stressed physically in the body. On the other hand, if we keep part of our awareness on looking for the places that tend to get tight and stressed, then when we are in difficult, challenging conversations, we're much less likely to react. What we can do is respond. Which brings me to the one of the most important points, which is, of course, what Tara Brach calls the spiritual bread, the pause. I said spiritual pause, she said. I didn't have it. Bread, being able to walk away, allowing ourselves to be able to take a pause and put aside things, to drop things when we've reached an impasse. This is very much part of the practice. Part of our tendencies is to be so glued to our thoughts, so attached to our thoughts, that when we're facing a problem, we think the solution is to think it through, to follow the thoughts all the way to the bitter end until we come up with a conclusion. And that's often one of the most least skillful approaches. One of the most skillful approaches when we're facing a problem is to put down the internal narrative, the problem in our minds, and to simply become present, focus, relax ourselves, focus on something else that doesn't cause stress. Often when we come back after a while, we have a new sense of what's important and what's not. We're less stressed, we're less defensive, we're less prone to get into an argument or a fight. But it's essential to learn how to first drop the thought. Because if we don't know how to drop thoughts in our meditation, it's going to be very difficult when we're in an argument with somebody else to say, you know what, we've reached an impasse, let's take a break, let's not think about this, let's just relax, let's put it aside and bring it back up when we're both a little calmer. It's very hard to do that when we don't have a spiritual practice in place. So the sacred pause is essential. Learning how to do it, when to do it, learning how to read when we're stressed and we're just not going to respond, we're going to react all the time, we're defensive, learning when it's time to put things down. Finally, this is my favorite topic about relationships, there's the magic of the new relationship. The neurotransmitters, I love, everybody loves the feeling of being in love at the beginning of it, right? That early flush, you don't want to see anyone else, you don't want to be any. The rest of your life recedes into a comfortable blur. I don't have to think about all those problems. This is amazing, this is wonderful. I'm in love. It's a wonderful cocktail of dopamine, glutamates, norepinephrine. There's a little bit of another neurotransmitter, a bunch of hormones, probably estrogen, testosterone. They're all floating in there, making that comfortable, druggy haze of the first 2.5 months of a relationship. Guess what happens in month 3? The neurotransmitters, I like making that sound, right? All right. The neurotransmitters start drying up. Suddenly, the backdrop of your life becomes more vivid. The problems return. You start feeling the stress in your body again because the reward chemicals in your brain have stopped masking them. Suddenly, you start realizing that you're edgy, you're uncomfortable, and your girlfriend or boyfriend said something you didn't like. Oh my God, this is not the love of my life. I've made a mistake. It's their fault. We blame the problem. We blame the re-arising stress on them. We think, oh, this isn't the person after all for me. Guess what? The magic of the flush of reward neurotransmitters is not meant to last. There is no example where it will last. It doesn't last. There are actually some very good charts if you want to read. There's a good clinical study on it mentioned in the Happiness Hypothesis, which is a terrific book of clinical studies, and it shows a chart of how long the reward neurotransmitters last, and then the slow, very slow growth of the neurotransmitters that are associated with love. However, those neurotransmitters like oxytocin, serotonin, are much subtler. They don't feel as overpowering. They're not going to make the rest of your life and your problems go away. They're subtle drugs, subtle neurotransmitters. And often that three-month decline of when we have the crash before there's the rising of the other neurotransmitters can leave us to feel, oh, it's not working out. We tried, but it's not working out. I can't tell you how many times I've talked to friends who just last in relationships for 2.5-3 months. They're like, I wonder why. You know, I always get that wall after 3 months, and then it goes. Then there's always something wrong with them. I find out something wrong. No, you're not finding out something wrong with them. What's happening is your brain chemistry is changing, and you're blaming it on the person you're with. So what this means is, A, if you really love that magical rush, it means that there's probably something missing from your life that you could give yourself in other ways. Becoming addicted to this is becoming addicted to something that's definitely not going to last. On the other hand, part of the beauty of meditation and spiritual practice is that we train the mind to focus on subtler, more rewarding states rather than always needing to feel good by whatever it is that we generally look to feel good by, that's our favorite blast-off good feeling. We learn to feel comfortable just sitting in the body and breathing. Once we can do this, we can also learn to feel really good being in a relationship without the blast of the early relationship feel-good chemicals, with just the chemicals that are the feeling of I'm in the right place. I'm with somebody that's accepting of me. I'm with someone who I feel comfortable with. Even though those feelings are nowhere near as strong, they are feelings that don't go away. We're not attaching to something that, or well, it can go away, but they stay a lot longer, and they're less dependent upon factors outside of it. They actually can go on for years and years and years and years and years. Whereas the early feelings of being in a fresh relationship rarely last for more than a couple of months. And part of the spiritual practice, the Buddha said, is learning to find causes of happiness that will last for long periods, not for short-term solutions. That's the reason why meditation also is such a blessing, because it's always there. It's always available. It's not dependent upon any other external situation. Just so, long-term peace of mind that comes with the more subtle feelings of a long-term relationship are much more skillful than the short-term blast, where we're not really aware of anything that's going on around us. So, that was my talk. Some thoughts on relationships and how some of this teaching might work with that. I hope you have some questions or thoughts and some of your own insights on what's worked as spiritual practitioners, how you put that into practice in your own relationships. So thanks for listening. Hey.